Hey everybody, welcome back to the podcast. This is show number 101, and this week's guest is Addie Carey. And Addie comes to talk to us about his slower approach to photography and building zines. Hey everybody, friendly friends, podcast listeners, welcome back to the show. We're back with show number 101. Andrew, how are you?
Okay.
Yeah. You? 101. I'm good. Yeah. Good. Good.
Room 101. Room show 101. 101 pinhole photography for dummies.
Yeah. Yep. I don't know. 101.
If we'd have thought deeply about it, it would have been a back to basic show, yeah. But we didn't.
So it's not. Good. What you been up to? Anything exciting?
Yeah. Cool. I've been slowing down, which is really interesting, considering our guest, who we'll introduce in a moment.
Yeah.
I've been slowing down, mainly carrying on with a theme that I've been talking about for a while now, which is exposing less film and concentrating on making final work. So I was getting a bit overwhelmed and swamped, really, a year or so ago, with just the amount of images and the different sort of projects and things going around in my head, you know. And this lockdown period, and now since I've stopped full-time work, it's just been the perfect time to just concentrate on one thing at a time. So I've been working on my USA road trip prints, getting through those, and dabbling a little bit more in lift printing, ready for produce some more small prints for sale. And then I feel under far less pressure now. I've just not discarded, but I've put to one side lots of other things. And that way of working may not suit everybody, but it's certainly suiting me. Cool. But I'm really excited to get back out when the weather improves a bit and do some more pinhole photography, because I've been a bit inspired by a lot of the stuff that people have been doing. Cool. And you've been messing around with... what's it? Chemical, haven't you? Monobath, that's it.
Yeah, well, you're talking about slowing down and I'm speeding up. With that, I'm back developing now, so that's fun.
Did you have some problems with the clearing of the images?
I did at first. At first, while I shot, well, I didn't leave it in long enough, you know, because you can leave it in up to 6 minutes. So if you do a roll and hasn't quite cleared, they say you can add more time or you can change the temperature. Yeah. So I kept the temperature the same and just added a little bit more time and developed another roll. And it came out almost perfect, just about, actually. Did a little bit longer of a pre-soak, and it cleared and it worked really good. So, yeah, I'm happy.
And some films you avoid, I think the instructions tell you to avoid.
Yeah, it says really
Burger
fast.
Burger films, is it? Burger?
Super fast film, you know. Mm-hmm. I think you have kind of a latitude with it of like a... pushing and pulling one stop, you know, that's about it.
Mm-hmm.
But box speed is pretty much kind of like more of where it's kind of shines. And that's kind of what I do. I don't do a lot of pushing and pulling, you know. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, but I developed two rolls, and with the Cine still, I think it's the DF96. And I like it. Yeah, it's good. It's really quick. 6 minutes in and out. Wash them and hang them up. I'm not really printing, so... just scanning and sharing that way. So that works fine for me. You know, I'm not really too concerned about exact, you know, densities and whatever.
You've still got your problem with chemical disposal, though, haven't you?
Yeah, but I'm going to kind of just go with the monobath and do the 15 to 16 rolls until it's exhausted and then, you know, just dispose of it. I don't know, responsibly is the best way to do it, you know. So I was thinking maybe I could, like, just dump it into a bucket, like a 5-gallon bucket with no lid, and put a bit of steel wool down there in the bottom, and that'll kind of grab all of the silver.
That's supposed to work, isn't it?
Yeah, and then it's just basically water, you know. Then you'll be fine to dispose of that, you know, just wherever. I could probably put that down my drain into my sewer, into my
You can drink it.
You know?
You could
if
drink
you want,
it.
You can. You can do lots of things with it.
You can.
But yeah, I didn't have any film. I went to go get some film out of my freezer. I had no film, so I had to order some film. And that's been about the...
What did you order? What's your go-to
film? I ordered, I like FP4, the Plus, FP4 right. Plus. So I ordered, I don't know, two or three rolls of that. Two or three rolls of the Pan F.
Yep.
And I think I even tacked on one of those, the Ortho in 120, the Ilford Ortho in 120 to see what that's like. That's kind of expensive. It's like $8, you know, so I was like, oh, I'm just going to try one. And the FP4 is only $5 or $6, you know, so.
Sounds about right.
Yeah.
Yep, excellent. Well, so we've touched on FP4 and we've touched on slow photography, so I think that's a perfect opportunity to introduce our guest. Shall I do that? So this week we're joined by Adi Terry. And how you doing, Adi?
I'm very good, thank you. Hello, how are you guys?
Thought you'd fall asleep there. Yeah, we're good. So I've been a fan of Adi's work for a while, and we follow each other on Twitter. I don't know how long we've been following each other on Twitter, but, you know, Adi's one of these guys who pops up. And I think what really drew me to get in touch with him with some recent pinhole stuff he was sharing, and I'd been aware that he produces a beautifully published magazine. I won't call it a zine because that's just a horrible abbreviation. This is a proper sort of photography magazine. And I thought, well, let's get him on the show to talk about his pinhole work. But actually, it's far, AD's story is far more involved and interesting than just pinhole. So AD, yeah, tell us a little bit about yourself and how you got to this point.
Okay. And okay. Are you into salt prints or not?
No. He's not into salt prints, no.
No. So I started photography as a very young boy, really. My father was very much into his photography. I picked up a camera aged 10 or 11 and started shooting butterflies and that kind of thing because Dad's into his wildlife. And then we moved to Lincoln, and there was an RAF base nearby which had very big bombers flying out of it at the time, Vulcan bombers. And I became a bit of a plane spotter, and then natural progression was starting to take pictures of planes rather than taking pictures of butterflies. And in the mid-1980s, there wasn't really a great career path to be had in Lincolnshire, and Lincoln in particular. So the RAF was a route, and joining the military was a route that was a distinct possibility. Having been into the careers office and discovered that the RAF allowed you to join as a photographer straight from school at aged 18 and a half, I snapped their hand off. I joined literally at 18 and a half to do my basic training at RAF Cosford in the West Midlands. I left there in 1987, went to a headquarters strike command unit, which it was in High Wycombe. And part of the photography trade group was not necessarily taking pictures, but printing magazines. So you can see there's a correlation already. When I got a notification of a posting after 2 years at High Wycombe, that was clearly going to a photographic unit. So I quickly refreshed in their photo section before going to join the army for what turned out to be 6 years and the end of my military service. I found that having worked with the army, it was impossible to go back to working with the RAF for lots of reasons, just mainly around the specialization that the army was very different and a very different beast from the RAF photographic section. So I left and have freelanced as what I now call an editorial photographer, which is simply providing images for newspapers, magazines, and more so nowadays, companies who need annual report pictures, that kind of thing. So corporate communications, whether that be internal stuff or external stuff. So that's kind of the professional career. And then for my own personal sanity, what I've developed is working with film and going film cameras and doing things slightly differently and slightly slower, not this instant gratification that you get with digital photography. And not using digital cameras for my own personal work. So everything for me is now film and is a combination of either Pentax 6.7, Hasselblad, or the LaRouge. I have bought a Holger, which I've not had very long, and I've put a couple of rolls through and haven't really got anything I particularly like right now. So that's something that needs a little bit of work on and probably a tape measure to get used to knowing exactly where it needs to be for some getting something a bit more in focus than I've managed so far. So that's a very brief kind of where I've got to.
Yeah. A cool trick for that Holger is just use your arm. Hold your arm out.
Is that right?
A meter? 3 feet. It's 3 feet. That's what I do. I just hold it to the end of my finger, you know, like don't get any closer than that.
All right.
Yeah, okay. That's a pretty good, if you want to do portraits of people, which is what I love doing with the Holger, I don't think I've ever had one really that hasn't been tack sharp because I just hold it about arm's length from them and then I move it up slightly into the left to compensate slightly for parallax.
Yeah. Just
error at that close distance. And, you know, the sweet spot in most Holgers tends to be in the middle because why wouldn't it be? Because that's, you know, that's where the light is going in a straight line. Once it goes in another part of the lens, it's going to be bounced in goodness knows what way. but it certainly won't be consistent. So you, from one to the other, you do get different effects around the edges. But you, generally, that's sort of sweet spot in most Holgers. So people say Holgers aren't sharp, but I've had four or five, and I've never had one that wasn't sharp. You've just got to get used to sort of estimating that distance really.
So I need to clearly spend a bit more time then. That's the take home for that one. Yeah, definitely. Yeah. And I have literally only put two rolls through and it was not quite haphazard, but a little.
That's good. Haphazard's good. It just takes practice, you know.
Find some subjects or some pictures that, you know, you've got your pinhole pictures down on the coast with the groins in the water, something bold and graphic, and, you know, work on something like that. But, and I think those bold and graphic subjects work pretty well with the Holger. Really anything that you use a pinhole for, I think a Holger is probably, except that you can't get quite as close.
You can put a filter on it and put it in bulb and do a little bit of those long exposure silky water shots with it too.
Right. You can. Okay.
Yep. And I've held up close up lens in front of it, and instead of three feet, I've just gone to 1.5 feet, and that's been brilliant as well. So, you know, don't overthink it too much.
But still, think about it.
That makes sense.
So going back to the RAF, where did you travel the world, and what sort of, you know, without sort of giving away too many secrets, what sort of things were you photographing? Were you photographing military things or sort of PR things for the Air Force?
So kind of a little bit of both, really. So there is a, during your training, you kind of do a bit of everything. So technical photography, broken bits of kit, photographing aeroplanes, and then also portraiture, that kind of thing as well, because obviously you need to keep the military in the public eye and keep those stories and the quality of the work at a certain level, that kind of thing. And people like to see military exercises, that kind of imagery. So it was that kind of thing generally. And then there was quite a lot of mundane stuff. So we were, when I was working with the army, we were a teaching unit. So we taught photography to soldiers who weren't necessarily photographers, but needed a degree of photographic knowledge to perform their jobs better. So they didn't need to go to the main school of photography to have that done. And they came to, on part of their course, they would have a couple of weeks where they did work with us. So there was quite a lot of instruction in that kind of part of the job. which was where I learned to use long lenses and started to become a sports photographer, because I was using long lenses to help teach these guys how to use long lenses, which in the RAF we didn't really do. So you have to go remember that this is kind of back in the 1980s. So most of our photographic sections, we pretty much exclusively used medium format. Very few people used 35 mil at all. And even when you did, you didn't have a great selection of lenses. So all our stuff was done on blads. It was predominantly black and white. There was a little bit of color stuff, more so for me being based at High Wycombe, because that was a headquarters unit. But out in the normal units in the 1980s, it was pretty much all black and white. But the great thing about the job was you learnt everything. So you learnt how to expose properly. You learnt how to process your negs properly. You learnt how to print properly. And that also was the case when started to go over to color and use C41 dip and dunk machines and that kind of thing. There was a lot of hand printing. The majority of our stuff was hand prints rather than machine prints. So we would machine process. So we had a then process, have to use dishes all the time, which was a huge advantage if you were doing batch prints of, you know, sometimes in a HQ unit, you would do 100 pictures of the same picture because you were sending it out to all the newspapers and those kinds of people. So it was much easier to do 100 prints through a printing machine than it was to do it through doing it in tanks or in dishes. So that was a great thing to actually learn, and really helps with the digital darkroom even, because you can do things very finite in digital darkroom that you would have struggled a little bit more in a traditional way. So you had that broad spectrum, and that meant that you were capable of doing pretty much anything. There are things that I choose not to do, and I think there's some specializations which, for instance, architectural photography, I don't have 5x4, I don't have PC lenses, that kind of thing. So that kind of work I wouldn't have. But the majority of the rest of things I'm pretty happy to do. And, you know, it's a fantastic career. And now with the way that the military operates now, and that they're, you know, you can follow some of the individual unit photographers across the RAF and across the military on Twitter, and the stuff that they turn out is beautiful.
So when you were photographing in the military, presumably you weren't blessed with massive choices of film stock. I'm guessing that you had one or two choices.
In the Air Force, that was probably the case. But because of the nature of the unit in the Army that I worked for, no, we could probably get our hands on anything that we wanted.
Okay.
So we did have, we had a dev chart that had all sorts of films on it, most of which the sergeant major in the section had actually used, and it was his crib sheet, which I still have, and I still sometimes use. The majority of the training for the student was done on HP5, because it was a great all-rounder. Nice. You could push it to the ends of the earth. And we would push it 6400 and beyond, dev it in microfen. And, you know, we would dev volumes of film from training exercises from these guys going out doing their jobs. So it wasn't unusual for us to perhaps do a couple of hundred rolls in a night.
Wow.
So this was perfect grounding. And we'll leap somewhat more forward in time now to hone in on pinhole work. We've got a lot more to talk about, but let's talk a little bit about your pinhole work. And, you know, you produce a wonderful magazine, and in that you're talking about some, I read that you were talking about some of your film choices. So do you want to just share with the audience your film choices for pinhole and what really works for you. And I guess hints and tips for people working
okay,
with film.
Okay, so...
In pinhole cameras.
So my pinhole, the thing that I first... I got the pinhole as a fun camera to not...
This is the LaRouge 66, isn't it? French camera.
Yeah, so this is a LaRouge. I'd already had one of the Ilford Obscura 5x4s. You know, the plastic mm-hmm. ones that you squeeze together. And I bought one of those, and I did use it, but I never processed anything from it because I discovered that 5.4 was so expensive to do as sheet film. And I didn't have an insert for my Patterson dev tank. So I still haven't processed those. So I went off pinhole for about 18 months, and then I saw these LaRouges advertised. And what attracted me to them was, one, that they were very simple. And two, they looked like they had quite sharp images. Now, obviously, pinhole is never sharp, but they looked really quite nice in the advert. And it was only 80 euros. So I asked my other half if she'd get me one for my birthday. And having got one, I took it out, played with it a couple of times, took a couple of pictures, learned a little bit about it, and took one image, which was a picture taken down at Folkestone Warren, which is where my exhibition has come from for Perfect Imperfection. And when I took it out of the tank, I just looked at it and went, wow, that's gorgeous. And I was kind of hooked then. And unfortunately, again, it's one of those things where work can get in the way of your personal work sometimes. So I'd stopped using it for a while. And then one day I thought, the weather is fantastic. Let's go back to Folkestone and shoot some more pictures using the pinhole. And I still didn't really quite understand how close I needed to be. And at that point, I was using Retro 400, Rolly Retro 400. And Superpan 200. Nice. Yep. But I did discover that I do have a slight polyester films within the pinhole that it's difficult to actually get them to wind on tight onto the take-up reel. So I fogged a couple irretrievably, but now I take along a Japan Camera Hunter little box and a dark bag, and I just sit on the beach and change the film in the dark bag, put it into the light tight box, and then bring them home, and that's worked an absolute treat. Films
nice.
On there, well, I've pretty much used the whole spectrum of things. I really like, on softer days, the Burger Pancro 400. And I've really fallen in love recently with Tri-X, which is a film I've not really used a great deal, but I've kind of moved away from Ilford just purely because of these snowy issues that they've been having with backing papers, especially on things like HP5. But it's also happened to me now on FP4, and I love FP4. It's my... in my second issue of Slow Photography, I call it my comfy slipper. You know what you're going to get with FP4. It's such a beautiful film. You can push and pull it a little bit if you want to, but I tend to, personally, I have always exposed it as 100, not 125, and still dev'd it as one. I love it as a film, and it's such a shame that there's that Ilford are having those problems at the moment. And you mentioned also the Ortho 80 that you'd bought in 120. I've had half a dozen rolls of that, love it. And one of my favorite pictures taken at Folkestone is with the Ortho. I thought it would work quite well because the metal groins are rusted so that they're red, and it doesn't really see red particularly well. The Ortho know that they're going to go nice and black. Yeah.
nice.
Yeah,
dark.
So you've got this automatically, you've got this beautiful contrast and strength in that picture already, because you're not using necessarily all the color that's available if you've been using a straight pan film. So that's worked quite neatly too. Virtually everything that's in the exhibition or in the magazine or on the website are full frame pictures. One of the great things that I found about the pinhole is I actually get my horizon straight, which I can't do with any of the other cameras that I own. However hard I try, I always have a slight slope to my pictures. And obviously the LaRouge has a little spirit level on it, which is great. And I've developed a technique for aiming. So as you'll know, you can buy some beautiful pinholes with little viewfinders built in on top and all sorts of things and little gadgets that help you. But I discovered that line it up is to sit directly behind the number window on the back of the camera and just imagine looking straight through the back of the camera and what's in front of you to about 100 degrees on those LaRouge is what you've got. So if you draw a line down the middle and then say 45 degrees that side, 45 degrees that side, and it'll be a little bit more than that, that's what I'm going to have in my picture.
Cool.
And the groins, I've worked out that I can be about 18 inches to 2 feet away from them and still get them in top to bottom. So that's kind of how I line them up. And I use a tripod, obviously, because exposures across that group of pictures, the exposures, the longest one is about 15 seconds. And the shortest one are sort of 1 or 2 seconds. I did have a little bit of an issue with the LaRouge right at the beginning, where if you look in magazine number 2, there's a picture of some snowdrops. And that has a little, on the right-hand side of that frame, it has a pale mark. And I thought that that pale mark was actually a very close snowdrop that had blown in the in a bit of breeze in front of the in front of the pinhole. And then I realized that my little finger was sticking out when I was pushing the shutter open. And it's actually the end of my finger in that picture. So I adapted my pinhole a little bit, and I used a wooden chopstick that I brought home from Wagamama's and cut it in half and then screwed it on the front. And now I've got a longer lever to operate the shutter window with, which means I can do shorter ones and much more accurately, more smoothly. And I've not got the worry of moving the camera, because one or two times originally when I first went down there, I did have a bit of an issue with having a little bit of camera movement. The other thing that I had also was tripod movement, because you needed to be so close. Basically, you have to get wet pretty much for every picture that you want to take of those groins, because the tide's going to wash up. But the beach there is sand, so, and it's very light sand as well, so it's very viscous when the water goes into it. So what I found was, if you just put the tripod on the top without digging it in, when the wave washed up the tripod and then it went back down the beach, what you found was the tripod would sink into the sand during your exposure. So that wasn't great. So it was a bit of a learning process to start with. And then I've kind of perfected it a little bit. And now I'm quite confident that when I go down there, I go down and I'm going to come back with what I actually want. But I do tend to only work in conditions that are generally 100% cloud or pretty close to it, but the cloud can't be a single block of gray. It needs to have color to it. It needs to have shape. It needs to have some form. So it needs to it. I don't like the pretty much the plain sky. The reason I don't go down in sunshine is just purely because it's a south-facing beach, you're going to have issues with flare and stuff. And all of a sudden, instead of this camera being a bit of fun and, for want of a better word, a toy, it suddenly became deadly serious. And for the last, well, certainly from tail end of 18, January 2019, probably, certainly for all of 2019, my sole focus of personal work was Pinhole and to shoot Folkestone. And that was pretty much the only thing I did. I didn't use the Blad very much, didn't use the Pentax very much. And as far as processing, everything's done at home. Generally, I use Rodinol, but there's in Folkestone, we're also quite lucky that there's a great little camera shop called Nick and Trick. If you haven't seen it on the internet, you can search it on the internet. He's very much into his film photography and has got lots of different things that you can buy, odd films, aerographic films, all sorts of things that are odd things that you wouldn't normally find. And he's pointed me in the direction of a few things too, which are a little bit away from your normal developers. So he's got a thing with Bellini and Hydrofen is a really nice liquid dev that keeps relatively well, is very similar to Rodinol kind of in dilution so that you don't use much. And I've been using that quite a lot with, I've used that with Tri-X. I've used it with the 80, but for the Superpan and Retro 400, I pretty the Rodinol and either do 1:50 or 1:100, sometimes 1:25. I'm not consistent necessarily with dilutions. I kind of do what I fancy with, and I think about what the actual images were. If it was a contrasty day, I might do it so that I can make it a little bit more contrasty. If it was a flatter day, sometimes I make it super flat. One thing that I really like about the Burger Pancro is just how soft and gradacious it is. It's beautiful. That again, I was recommended by Richard to do that in his Bellini Hydrofen, and that is just gorgeous. So, you know, I'm not, I would like to say I was loyal, and I was very loyal to FP4, and I still love it, but I'm less loyal now on using the right film for the right day. And obviously with exposure, you're looking at your image in front of you of the waves washing up the beach and coming back down the beach, and you're counting how long it takes the wave to come up the beach and go back, or whatever you're looking for in that picture before you really make your film selection as to what you're going to put in the camera, because that's one of the parts of your exposure equation is the ISO that you're going to use. So you've got to know what you want to finish your finished article to look like to make sure that you put the right roll of film in there in the first place. And generally when I go to Folkestone, I probably only shoot, so I don't really shoot lots of pictures. Often because I'm going in the cold winter and I'm either half submerged to my waist in cold English seawater. And after that period of time, you actually want to go home. But, you know, the thing that I do is I use a tripod and a clamp. The clamp is useful because you can clamp it directly onto the grains. So you can clamp it to one graph the one in front. And if you can't get quite the position or the angle at which you want, I sometimes will put the clamp on the tripod leg and operate it from the tripod leg, because then I've got all that stability of the tripod dug into the sand, but I can get quite low. And I would say that the Le Rouge is very waterproof. It's been submerged a couple of the time. Did it actually get the film inside wet, which was brilliant.
Nice.
That's good. Yeah. Well, that's really comprehensive. Thank you. This business with Ilford worries me a bit, because I've seen, Ilford's been my go-to film for a long time. I'm not exposing much film at the moment. I have got a fridge full of a brick of HP5, which I purchased late last year from somewhere. So it's the new stuff. And I've been working through some not expired stuff. I bought some stuff that Andrew Atkinson from the Pinhole Group was getting rid of, and I bought that. And I've exposed all of that, and I haven't noticed anything that resembles sort of snow or weird things going on. But I read lots of issues and folks, getting a bit hesitant about using some Ilford film stocks. And but more importantly, I've not seen any kind of response, certainly not online, to Ilford. I get the impression that if you actually approach them, they kind of replace batches of film. But, I don't know if anyone knows how much of an issue this is, what Ilford are doing about it. I guess they must be aware of it because they must be. Because they're on social media.
Yeah, there has been some.
I mean,
There has been some traffic, and they are aware of it, and they are trying to fix it. And it isn't everything, so it is very intermittent, which is the difficult bit. If it was consistent, then it would be much easier to probably solve. Mm. But the fact that it's what it looks like, and we used to have this many, many years ago. What it looks like to me is kind of dampness that gets onto the backing paper for one reason or another. And if you put your film in the freezer and take it out, put it in the freezer, take it out, put it in the freezer, take it out, put it in the freezer, take it out, and then eventually use it, you find that somewhere along the line it's got condensation on it as it's warmed up, cooled down again, warmed up, cooled down again. And it looks a little bit like that. How it's got there, don't know. It is awkward. I did actually, one of the pictures that is in the magazine was shot on FP4 with it. And I did, because I liked the picture so much, I persevered. One of those pinholes, I persevered and actually touched out every single piece of the snow that was on there. It took a long time. But some of the others, I just, the other stuff on that roll, I just looked at and went, there's nothing there that I'm going to waste my time on, and didn't bother. So I just chose what was kind of the best picture, and that was it.
Is it, if it is something like that, it won't be specific to one particular film. It'll be down to something in the logistics of the production, which is leading to that.
Yeah, or it might even be in the place which makes the backing paper. So you don't even, it's one of those things that if you're worried, then you move away for a little while and see what happens. And there are other things out there that you can play with. And there's some great films around. And that Burger Pancro 400 is beautiful. If you haven't ever used it, give it a go, because it is fantastic.
I have. I've used a couple of rolls, but I've not persevered with it. Mainly because of my loyalty to Ilford stuff, I guess.
Well, you guys got me worried, because I've just ordered 6 rolls of it. Maybe I won't put mine in the freezer. I think I'll just keep it in my.
If you're storing roll film in the fridge, I mean, my stuff's in the fridge, but I always make sure it's sealed up. If I've got a roll which has been taken out of its plastic foil, then I'll make sure that's wrapped up in something, like plastic foil or a bag or
I don't put any of my film in the fridge, to be honest, because I don't buy it in a quantity enough to not use it that quickly. Yeah. So I just keep all of it in ambient room temperature, and that goes for color and color tranny, and
I think that's fine, really. I keep mine in the fridge because it's just a place to keep it.
Yeah.
really.
True.
But I think you're probably right. You know, I mean, I don't hoard film, but I'm not really getting through it very quickly just at the minute because I'm printing.
Yeah, yeah.
Printing more. Mm. So, Adi, you're very much into slow photography. Talk a little bit about that as a concept, and surely you can apply it to digital photography. Yeah, absolutely, you can. As well.
So the slow photography really came about as partly a concept for camera clubs. I do quite a lot of talks to camera clubs about some of my photography, my career or sport or reportage, that kind of thing. But one thing that struck me quite quickly with talking to people was that the people who were at camera clubs were very orientated towards competitions and kind of always went out to shoot competition pictures, but didn't really know what they were going out to try and shoot. So I then developed a talk which was called Thought Processes and Technical Details, which really goes along the lines of working a little more professionally, in that you go out with an idea of what you want to come back with. And that helps you make sense of the camera that you're going to take, the lenses that you're going to take, the way that you're potentially going to process it when you come back, how you're going to produce that image, and making sure that you think about going out to take your picture and not just going out with the hope that you'll turn up a competition winner. So what I did was I talked about how a lot of my clients will give me a brief. Now that varies from certain people me going, AD, can you come along and take some pictures, to AD, here's a flat plan of our magazine. These are where the pictures are going to go. This is the picture that's going here. This is the picture that's going there. I'll be there with you on the day and we will tick them off as we go. Yeah. So it's a combination of that, really. And it's to try and get people to think about what they want to do, what they want to achieve, and that end result, the finished picture, before they've even walked out of the door, so that they have an idea and a concept of something as a finished product. Now, that doesn't mean that you don't go with the ability to take something that just turns up because you're fortuitous. You've got to still be able to do that. I'm not trying to stop people from just taking the random thing that appeals to them as they walk along the road. But the thing is, if you're going to go to Folkestone Warren and you're going to take some pictures of the groins, you've got to know certain pieces of information before you get there. And that's not necessarily just about your camera and your camera equipment. You've got to know where the tide is, whether it's coming in or going out, how big it is. Yeah. Those kinds of things help you make the decisions that you're going to make to give you the finished article of your finished picture when you come home. And obviously with the skills that you have in Photoshop or printing in a dark room, you can then manipulate that to produce that vision that you had before you walked out the door. It's very rare that I go out even taking pictures for myself, and even like this afternoon when the snow was falling here, I went out with very much an idea of what I wanted to produce and how I was going to produce those pictures. There was probably a bit too much snow falling for me today, so I didn't quite what I wanted. But ultimately, you did have a vision before you went out of the door. And for me, that's kind of where the slow photography concept came in. Now, the first three editions of the magazine, they were all film. But in the fourth edition this year, I have used digital imagery, which wasn't forced upon me. But I thought that because we were now in COVID lockdown and I'd shot quite a lot of pictures in our garden, we've just moved house and a garden in the south of England, but now we're in the Midlands, we have. And I didn't know half of what this stuff was. And I had quite a lot of spare time because there's no commissioned work in the editorial business at the moment for freelancers. It's very difficult to get work. So I was spending quite a lot of the time in the garden just photographing bits and bobs, flowers, using my macro lens that I hadn't used for a long time, and just thinking about how I could create pictures. But not only that, but also learning a little bit about post-production of those, and then going back outside and thinking about how I can improve the picture that I did last time with the exposure, how much depth of field, those kinds of things, and then the post-production techniques as well. So it's all about a package. And the image that's on the front of the third edition, which is a picture of an F-15 Eagle coming into land at RAF Lakenheath in Suffolk, is an image that was 7 years in the making. I had this idea of a picture one day when I was sat outside Lakenheath watching the jets come in, but didn't really give it a great deal more thought that day, and thought it's really going to work, it's got to be done. And then about 5 years after I had that initial thought, I went and actually did it. And I shot it digitally, and it had a very grey sky, a very flat grey sky. And it was a lovely picture, but I looked at it and went, I can do that better, and I'm going to do it better, and I'm going to do it better on film. So the one on the front of issue 3 is shot on the Pentax 6.7. And... Say again.
That's a beast.
Yeah. So it's on the it's on the Pentax 6.7 with a wide-angle 45mm lens. And it's shot on Super Pan because I wanted that to try and get a bit more contrast in the sky. It's also got an orange filter on the front to try and give a little bit more contrast to the sky. It's still not quite what I want. And because it's still not quite what I want, I shall... I can do it again until you kind of get the perfect image. I'm always very critical of my own imagery to look for the little flaws, look for ways of improving them. How can I improve that picture? And that's also part of that slow photography concept, because especially if you're shooting digitally, you have so much information nowadays that enables you to critique your own work with the EXIF information, that you know all the exposure information that you've put into it. But next time you can go out and you can improve. And if you learn from your mistakes, it should make us all better photographers. And slowing down is certainly a way of actually becoming a better photographer, because you take time to look and to observe and not just rush it and point the camera and then move straight on after having just made a quick cursory look at the back of the camera to make sure that you had an image. So that really for me is kind of how it progressed into becoming the magazine that it is. And it, and, you know, the content fluctuates a little bit with reviews of bits of kit. They're very gentle reviews. They're not technical reviews, because if you want a technical review, there's lots of magazines out there who do it already and probably do it significantly better than I can do it. But I give you tips and tricks and talk about why I like using certain films, and where possible give you some information to the combinations of kits. One of the things I didn't want to do was go into making copious amounts of notes for all of the images. Ultimately, that's not really kind of how I work as a photographer, especially for my own personal work. And then it would have moved it into a different place. Some of it I am conscious of. I'm shooting a specific thing, maybe for the magazine, and therefore I do make a mental note of what it was. But because I'm processing my black and whites at home, and I predominantly shoot black and white imagery, I make those notes either when I come home or the next day once I've processed the film. And I might tweet a couple of pictures but also I've got a blog, which is a medium format only blog, film blog, which generally has more images than I put onto Twitter. Sometimes I'll just put one, sometimes I put a block of four. It doesn't, it's either one or the other, really.
I did have
an Instagram, but I gave that up very quickly. And I've never done at all. So, yeah, social media, I'm not particularly adept at social media, I would have to say. But I do keep and try and keep rotating stuff over. So there's always something new.
You could use Instagram. I mean, I have an Instagram account for pinhole work, and I think that works quite well. I started off just having it as a sort of a vehicle for my images, but I put other pinhole related stuff on there now as well. Yep. Like if I'm building a camera out of a tin or something, that goes on there. But these, I'm looking at issue 4 of Slow Photography now, the proper printed version, and the pictures are great, and the production quality and the way you put these things together are great. And I think you, and of course they're square images, so they're perfect for Instagram. So I would commend you to jump back in and put some of these on Instagram. You might sell more issues of Slow Photography as well, which is a great magazine. I don't know how often you look to put it out. I bought issue 4 from you when I happened to just see it on Twitter. I'm hopeless at following people on blogs. I do try, but you know, there's so many people doing so many things. So a lot of it is kind of just what I happened to see online. And I saw Slow Photography and I saw these great pictures of the groins. And I don't know if groin is a word that you're familiar with. It's not the thing down at the top of your legs, Corey.
We have those here.
Yeah, the things in the sea. Originally, yeah. they would have had boards in them, and there's to stop the movement of sand across to stop coastal erosion. But you end up with these posts, don't you? And of course, a fantastic set of images. Tell us a little bit. We're probably drawing to the end. Corey gets twitchy at an hour. But tell us a little bit about the production of Slow Photography, where people can get hold of it. I mean, we had a little bit of chat off air about producing zines, and everybody seems to be doing it. This is an A4 quality, thick, heavyweight paper, from what I can tell. You know, it's almost got the feel of fibre paper about it, in a matte finish. You got some neat little bit of advertising at the end, and you advertise FP4 and things. Yeah, so tell us how you put this together without giving away too many secrets. But for those wanting to produce something as high quality as this,
okay. So initially, all four editions of Slow Photography have actually been put together using Photoshop. In Photoshop, once you've done your pages, you can then group them all together and make a PDF. So that then you can send that PDF to your publishing house. In this case, Mixam, which is in the UK, but is also now has a franchise around the USA as well. So for those people across the pond, they can use them. You've got a selection of papers. You've got a selection of sizes. You can make your own choices as far as that goes. Page making in Photoshop, I found very easy after I'd watched a couple of videos.
Let me just ask a question there, because I don't even have an up-to-date, modern paid
Elements
version of Photoshop. I have some
some
version of Photoshop Elements 14, I think. And the only thing I use that for is picking off dust spots and just sliding along the contrast or something, and then that's it as far as my skills are concerned. So can I do this?
I would have thought so, because what you'll find is that, because basically what you're doing is you're making an image.
Right.
So in essence, you're going to do file new and make an image, which is going to be a white background. You're then going to a photograph on top of it, and then a text box on top of that. And you're then going to either type in your text to the text box or just copy and paste it out of Word. Yeah. So that's the very abridged version of how you could make a page. It's a little more complicated than that. But once you've done it, it's really simple. It's really relatively quite quick. But when I had just finished issue 4, I was looking on Twitter and somebody else had just said, oh, I'm sending my magazine to Mixam for printing. And he'd done a screen grab of his pages, but he'd also left in his software program, which was a company called Affinity Publisher. So I looked up Affinity Publisher on the internet, discovered that it was virtually the same as Adobe InDesign and worked virtually the same way. And instead of being £20 a month, it was £50 for a one-off fee. So I pretty much bought it there and then. I have now taught myself, and with the use of a very thick workbook, which Affinity also produce, I've taught myself using Publisher to now make the next edition of Slow Photography using the Publisher software, which will enable you to make it quicker, make it easier. And it's a lot easier to import your text using Affinity. Now, you know, we've kind of gone on from being very basic to suddenly becoming quite skilled into making your magazine. But ultimately, you can, this is 28 pages. Once you've made a template for the page that you want to do, so the size, and there's information on Mixam's on their website about bleeds, so that if you're going to run a picture right to the edge, you need to actually run it beyond the edge. Otherwise, you might get a little white edge around your image when you get it back. So because obviously I'd done printing in the REF when I was a 19-year-old kid, I understood the printing process and what I needed to do relatively well. So designing and stuff was a bit more difficult. I've tried to keep them relatively consistent, but if you've got all four editions, you'll notice that the copy size, the text size for the fonts has changed significantly. It enables me to get a few more words in, but also it's not quite so large. It was too big in the first couple of editions. So it's become a little bit of a work in progress. Issue 5 will happen. The problem that you find with them as entities is that they really do hoover up your content really quickly. 28 pages takes, especially like with the pinhole where I did a couple of pages that have got four pages or four pictures on a page. Well, you've done 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. You've done 6 pages of actual pictures and you've got 10, 12 pictures in there. Yeah. So you're using your content quickly. So having a body of work first before you put them together is a good thing. But obviously you can make them as big or as little as you want them to be. So you could make a little A5 one that's only got 10 or 15 pages, or obviously in groups of 4, but, you know, 16 pages rather than 28. And they're relatively cheap and they are actually quite good value for money. And they are nice printed. So.
I think the difference, AD, with yours from, I buy quite a lot of zines from folks that I see producing them, and they tend to be, well, certainly smaller than this, probably A5 size.
Yep.
And they'll be about one body of work, you know, so be it, you know, like recently, I purchased one from someone on Twitter who'd done, uses the...
Oh, is this Dave and Ellen?
Panoramic camera, you know, the...
Yeah, they're good.
120 view. Yeah, Dave. So Dave put out a picture. So excellent, yeah. And, you know, I have a compact as well. And, you know, so it's about a body of work. Yours is more like a magazine, isn't it? In that, you know, it's got four or five different articles in, but it's all you. You're not having contributors, so you know, but it is all you. So this is different, you know, and I commend you for it. It's excellent. Where will you take it from? I mean, you don't want to make it painful, do you? Really, you don't want to be stuck to, I must get one of these out, because it's your kind of work, and you know, you'll put it out when you've got enough meaningful material.
The first three were all in 2018, and then issue four was obviously in 2020. Issue five, I do have some designs on issue five. So the back end of issue four, there's a feature on the River Findhorn in Scotland, which is very much a progress. Mm-hmm. And it's something that I am going to go back and carry on doing. The difficulty, of course, is distance. So it's not somewhere that's on my doorstep to go and do. So you have to book your holiday and go and do it, and then hope that the weather's conducive at the same time. So that's something that I want to develop much further.
It's a lot.
Yeah, there will probably be more pinhole in the next issues. I am going to put some colour in Folkestone and shoot colour print. I've got some ideas for shooting slightly longer exposures and attaching it to the...
Yep.
I like the sea to be a reasonable size, so... That's something that you have to bear in mind as well. I don't like it being too benign, but equally you can't go when it's a really big sea, because obviously it chucks up quite a lot of debris at the same time. So it's got to be relatively powerful, but not storm force. And I generally prefer to work on an outgoing tide. So, but colour on there, I now think that there's colour in the waves that I would like to have something a little different from the black and white ones. I think as far as the exhibition goes.
Yeah. It won't really be monochromatic, but there won't be a wide range of colourful tones, but I can imagine it'll work really well in colour.
It'll still be nice looking.
Yeah, it will. But you're not down that way.
So
now,
we live
are you?
In,
you said, did you no, say you moved
so we live in
to the Midlands,
Oakham.
So you're
I
exactly
do still have to place in Kent, but it is hopefully on the way to being sold. Right. But obviously, I still have a lot of clients down there, and I have a lot of friends down there. So we will still spend time there. So that's not an issue.
You're only 45 minutes from me. So we're thinking about when we can get the caravan out. We've got our eyes set on some campsites.
Oh, don't tell them where you're at.
Right. Some campsites around Rutland.
Yeah, I was thinking of Hunstanton and those kinds of places as well, and as kind of my nearest piece of coastline, or Wisbeach or somewhere around there on the Wash. Definitely colour.
Mine too.
In there next time around, and maybe just if there's one more good day between now and actually getting the exhibition on the wall. The problem is I'd actually got the exhibition ready to go, because it was meant to go in on the 1st of April 2020. And then obviously lockdown came around and COVID and what have you. So I actually have all the prints already in frames, mounted 2024 frames to go on the wall. So I have an exhibition that is available to go at any moment. As always with these things, that there's always the possibility that tomorrow you might take a better picture and one of them will get dropped out. So, you know, you're always looking for, you're never satisfied. Yeah. You always kind of want to have, well, just if we had one more. So you're always in the pursuit.
You've got some lovely spots. We can have a pinhole meetup in good days. There's a few of us meet up once or twice a year. But if you head up towards Sutton Bridge on the Wash, and then north towards Guy's Head, the River Neen flows into the Wash there. And Guy's Head is a really interesting place to visit. So that's worth That's worth a visit. I've done quite a bit of pinhole photography around there, not to make really a body of work, but you know, one or two pics. And it's one of those places that you could just keep going back to, you know, because it's just
I'm a great believer in skies,
mud, things sticking out of the mud.
It's still nice to just go and No, I was going to say it's still nice to be able to go places and just shoot, just to take pictures, even if you're not going to plan on having it in a project or just to see what it looks like, you know.
Yep,
that's kind of where I'm at. I'm kind of just shooting to have fun.
Yeah, I don't think. Well, I'm sure AD is as well. I don't think he's. Yeah. This way of working appeals to AD. It may not appeal.
No, I think what you do need to keep going backwards.
Yeah, well,
going AD. Back to the same location because it's always different. And
yes, changes.
I think you're dead right, and on your doorstep, really, if you can make it. And of course, you're in a beautiful spot in Oakham. You've got all of Rutland Water around you, so. You know, I'm sure you'll find somewhere in your backyard to.
Yeah, I think there might even be some opportunity tomorrow stuff. With a little bit of snow on the ground. That's and supposedly the forecast tomorrow is quite nice. So, you know, there might be an opportunity to play tomorrow. So, you know.
Yeah.
Well, you'll get familiar with your new area, and it's, you know, looking at places with fresh eyes and, you know, fresh scenery is a good thing to do at times. AD, where can people find issues of Slow Photography? How can they look at your work?
The best place is adkerry.com, which is the website which has the pinhole on and a couple of reportage features. Also has some workshops that I can. Then you have Twitter, which is at AD Kerry. With so that's relatively easy to find. The difficult one is the medium format film blog, which is on Tumblr. But if you go to the website or to my Twitter, often there's links from there to pages. And obviously my email is on my website. So if anybody wants to get in touch with questions or wants a copy of the zine, they can either DM me through Twitter, they can email me through my website. So any of those is fine. I only have issue 4 though as available because the other 3 are sold out. So I've only got the current edition that's
Well, it's the one with the beautiful folks and pictures on the seaside in the pinhole. So that's.
Yep.
Corey.
Yes.
Andrew. Any last words?
No. Thanks for coming. It's great speaking with you. I did want to say thanks to. Did Garen send you one of these books, Andrew?
Yeah, the one of the power lines.
Yeah.
With his Holger.
Yeah, I wanted to say to him thank you because it's really nice.
Yeah, Garen, whose surname escapes me. Yes, is he on Twitter? I can't remember now.
He's on Instagram.
Yeah, I'm just trying to because AD, you were talking about your Holger and.
All right.
Garen put together a zine all about on the theme of power lines.
Yeah,
it's called something about the grid, and it's a great use of the Holger, and you know.
Yeah, and he shot it all on HP5 too.
He did not. I don't think there's any snow there, but you never know. Maybe he edited it all out.
Maybe. Who can ever tell? But I wanted to say thanks to Garen because
Forward to meeting you in Oakham by the wash when we can do such things.
I'm coming round and even having a go in your dark room, which you've been building.
Okay.
All right.
Yep. Well, the dark room's out. I need to make it bigger before I've kind of suspended Fenland workshops probably for this year. I think it's just hopeless trying to think about doing it while we're super viruses are spreading around the country and people are trying to get vaccinated. So I'll be making the darkroom a bit bigger than we'll probably be doing the Fenland workshops into the new year. next New Year.
Do I get a refund for my? Do I get a refund for my workshop that I paid for, Andrew?
Yeah, you need to buy your passport first.
I know, right?
Yeah.
Thank you very much for having me on. It's been a pleasure.
Well, Addy, thanks so much for hanging out, and we'll talk to everybody again soon. Yeah,
it's been great fun and some really interesting help and information for folks out there, whether they're pinholers or digital photographers or whatever.
Excellent. Thank you very much.
Or a book or anything.
Cheers.
Yeah.
Thank you very much, Andy.
Hi.
Cool. Everybody have a...
Got your electronic zines, which are magazines. Well, I don't know. Calling them a zine is really, I think, a bit disingenuous. It's a magazine, isn't it? It's a proper old-fashioned...
Yeah.
Not black and white, but, you know, photography magazine. Yeah.
Wonderful. Yeah, it's a bit difficult. You just don't quite know where to pitch. That's the trouble. So, you know, it's...